If I'm swimming for your childhood remains of, I've seen the rhetoricity of redundancies. For worry nothing, no one is rushing us into a place where our moral binds is way in front of our eyes. Blinding like the nodding tides, listening with one unplugged ear to avoid the information passively by, and I'd advise keeping your sanity in a tightly sealed jar so the refrigerator never runs too far into a place where our moral finds its way in front of our eyes, blinding like the knotted ties.
Awesome. So let's. I guess let's get going. Usually, I like to start with having, if I could have you introduce yourself to the listeners.
Okay. Do you want me to do that now? Do you want to...
Yes, please.
Okay. Hi, I'm PJ Holden. I'm a comic artist. I've drawn in the past for Dynamite Comics, doing RoboCop versus Terminator, Battlefields with Garth Ennis. I've drawn Fearless for Image Comics with Mark Sable and Dave Rothwriting. And most of my best known stuff has been for 2000 AD, drawn Judge Dredd and Rogue Trooper and various other things. And I have a new book out in July called Number Cruncher with Simon Spurrier.
And
That was a kick-ass introduction. It's like I'd reverse that.
Dude, that was concise. It's like you've done this before.
No, you'd think so, wouldn't you? Well, I do like to talk about myself, that's true.
Well, it's everyone's favorite subject.
It is, yeah, it is.
Tell me a little bit about Number Cruncher, because I've read the first issue, and it's fucking awesome. I enjoyed it very much. So can you give us sort of the elevator pitch of the first issue?
Okay, elevator pitch. It's about a it's about a mathematician who figures out that the entire universe is controlled by mathematics, and he figures out on his deathbed the formula to get him in front of the divine calculator, our universe's version of God, to ask to be reincarnated, so that he can go back to the woman he's always loved. And that's where it starts. That's the very premise of it. But it's really also about a guy called Bastard Zane, who is the enforcer, the afterlife's enforcer, who cuts a deal with the mathematician. The deal is that, okay, you'll be reincarnated, but at the end of your life, I will take your soul and I will be released from the servitude that I have. And it's that sort of dynamic between them. The mathematician is, who has got this incredibly complicated long-term plan, which the first issue really only shows you the first step. It's only really when you get to the second issue that things really kick off. But the first issue sort of sets the ground rules for how this universe sort of works. And it's sort of as subtle and as intelligent and as clever as the mathematician is, Richard Time, is Bastard Zane isn't. he's not relenting sort of machine of destruction. The other thing about it is that the story is told, the story is very non-linear. It's very linear. It's all told from Zane's perspective. So every minute of the story is with Zane, but the actual story of the mathematician hops through time. It goes back and forwards and hops to different points in over you know 70 or 80 years of a timeline, and it goes over itself and it's phenomenally common. I mean, there are things happening in that first issue that are inconsequential and have no apparent point or purpose, but pay back big time later on, and it's only in the second issue you get a sense of what's going on there. So I'm glad that you love the first issue, but it really kicks off from the second one.
That's interesting because, you know, I thought that the accountant was definitely, to me, the most interesting character in the story.
The divine calculator, the guy with the sort of peak cap and the haunched shoulders. Well, he's God, you know, he's the God character. And for him, everything works out in a balance sheet, and he sort of propels Zane on. But it's really, I mean, in some respects, it's a funny story because it's sort of... it's a complicated love story, but because readers don't buy complicated love stories. It's really a sort of almost a revenge film with Zane as the protagonist, a sort of Jason Statham-like thug who kind of basically he hasn't seen an obstacle he can't shoot in the head and walk over. You know, he's that unrelenting. He's like a Terminator in that respect. But so it's sort of it follows him because for the reader that side of the story is very straightforward, but the actual plot of it is very twisty.
See, I like there are a couple of ideas that the first issue introduced that I enjoyed very much. The first one is the idea that the afterlife is a bureaucracy that no one really enjoys.
Yeah,
I thought that was hilarious. And the question of, all right, so this guy is God, but where did he come from? What's his story? Why is he doing all of this? You know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I think there's a great history of the afterlife as a bureaucracy in movies, and I think it's a trope that you see more in movies from the 40s, from the 30s and 40s. So, for example, I mean, the film I'm always talking about when I talk about this book is a film called A Matter of Life and Death, which is a great 1947 or something, I think it was made. It's Richard Niven plays a World War II pilot who gets shot down and his plane crashes. And the angel who's supposed to come down is this sort of 17th century dandy who's supposed to go down and collect his soul is late. And because he's late, David Niven gives up and starts walking around and meets a nurse and falls in love. And the angel who's late for him takes him up to heaven, up these massive staircases. And in this film, the real world is full colour and heaven is this black and white world. And he takes him up to heaven. And we're in heaven. They find that he has to sit through a court case to determine whether he should be allowed to live any longer or whether his soul should be claimed now. So there's sort of he has to prove that he's really genuinely fallen in love. And it's genuinely their fault because he shouldn't have been let live, but because he's been let live, he should have that time. So that's one film with that sort of bureaucracy in it. There's a musical Carousel. I don't know if you've heard of the musical Carousel.
I haven't.
The famous thing from it is a song called "You'll Never Walk Alone," which is very in the UK. It's a very famous song. But it's about a guy who dies and he's up in sort of this afterlife, which is nothing like a sort of he cleans stars. You know, he's literally on a stepladder to shine in stars. And a guy comes up to him, says to him, "Your family's in trouble, and you can go back to Earth for one day." And the guy who sort of looks after as the gatekeeper for heaven and Earth is a character called the Starkeeper, and he is dressed exactly like that accountant. He's got the peaked cap and he's got the rolled up sleeves, and he takes a tally of everything going on. And it's almost like a trope that we've lost. It's a trope that sort of, as I say, in films from the 40s, it was very common. And somehow it's a thing that we don't do anymore in movies or in popular medium at all, in any sort of medium at all. So, but I've always loved stuff like that. I would always, if there's a film comes on, that I know has got, one of those elements, there's another one called, what's it called? It was remade with Warren Beatty as about a character who dies. And again, the angel sort of takes his soul away too early, and in this version of the afterlife, the heaven is like this giant airport terminal, and all the angels have got numbers. They're messengers.
The number you have reached has been disconnected.
Peter?
Oh, okay. Well, I think maybe it just twigged in. Okay. So anyway, there's a big long history of that kind of bureaucracy in movies, and that heaven as a bureaucracy in movies is a very common trope up until about the 40s and 50s, and then it stopped. So I don't think it's ever been done in comics, though.
Yeah, I've certainly never read it in comics. So if this was a common thing that has sort of seemed to fade away, how did the comic come How did the comic come to be? How did you and Cy end up working
on this? Well, I've known Cy since he was about 18 or something. Simon and I go back a long way. We've done small press stuff together for sort of 2000 AD fanzine type stuff. As both of us have kind of moved on up in our career, and you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, thank God. Anytime there's now a slightly prolonged silence, I'm going to panic. So Simon and I have known each other for a long time. And we've had a couple of sort of goes at doing creator-owned work. Creator-owned work is a bit like, I don't know, it can be... Creator-owned work can be one of those things that you talk about something, you talk about an idea, and it could be 2 or 3 years before it comes to any sort of fruition, or it may never happen because you've got to find a publisher who's interested and you've got to spend the time and you're not getting paid for it often, and it can be difficult. With Number Cruncher, what happened was the Judge Dredd magazine, which is sort of the sister comic to 2000 AD, mm-hmm. had opened up this slot for a creator-owned series and had asked Simon to do it. And Simon emailed me saying, PJ, do you want to do this series called Number Cruncher with the magazine? It's creator-owned. I went, yes. And he went, okay, here's the first script. It was really as simple as that. But the irony is we'd had a couple of goes at other creator-owned series that had gone nowhere. You know, they'd taken months and months and months of development and fiddling around and doing various things, and they just sort of died on the vine a bit. And this one was just, you know, it shows you that the key thing a lot of the time is whether a publisher is prepared to pay you money or not. Once you've got a publisher interested, then boom, that's it. Everything can start happening then. So, and Simon had, I don't think seeing it as a 4-issue miniseries is nice, and it's going to be great to see. But I don't think people realize just how much work went into it, because the book originally was 8 pages per month over 9 months, which meant that some of the stuff that happens in the first couple of pages play out over the course of the 9 months that we did it. And of course, when you're doing stuff over that extended a time frame, you don't really quite know. You know, you draw a character one way and you don't quite know if he's going to look exactly the same at the end of 8 or 9 months, because, you know, your art moves on and how you mm-hmm. do things changes and so on. So it was kind of the reprint and what Titan are doing, they're recollecting it, or rather they're collecting it for us. And because they're collecting it, we're taking the opportunity to go in and add extra pages to help explain and expand various things. And I'm tweaking some of the artwork so that some of the things that happen in those first early bits play out exactly as they should do later on down the line, because there are things that happen more than once in the comic, let's put it like that, and you're dealing with time travel, so it's, you know, but I don't think any of that happens in the first issue. I don't think you realize in the first issue that this is going to be a time travel comic, really.
No, I didn't get it.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things. It's sort of what you'll find in the second issue is that the idea of reincarnation can be cheated, because the divine calculator is not a nice man to deal with. If he cuts a deal with you, you're going to come out of it the bad end of it. And so Richard Tyne, the mathematician, wants to be reincarnated so he can be with the woman he loves. And the divine calculator goes, fair enough. And he allows him to return reincarnated as a baby, but at a different point in time from the woman he loves. And that sets off the double crossing and the triple crossing and the quadruple crossing that happens all the way through. So
in revisiting the work and collecting it into issues, mm-hmm. I noticed that Jordi Belair is coming on to do some coloring.
She is, yes. Jordi, when we drew it originally, it was drawn the series. We didn't really have the budget to go full color, so the slot was a black and white slot, so we couldn't go full color. So I drew it. The afterlife stuff is done in this grey wash, and it's sort of drawn with a pen, and then it's had a grey wash applied to it. And then the real world stuff is drawn with a brush, and it's a very thick, contrasty black and white art style. And the idea was always that at some point we'll take the real world end of it and get it fully coloured. And that's what Jordi's going to be doing. Jordi's going to be colouring all of that. And there are bits where some of the stuff from the afterlife crashes into the real world. So, for example, there will be scenes later on where Bastard Zane is walking around in the real world. But in that he will be greywashed and the real world around him will be full color. Yeah. So you'll see that, and it should look really spectacular, I think.
I sort of noticed in the first issue the two worlds bumping up against each other when Bastard Zane came to collect Richard.
Mm-hmm.
After like sort of like the reveal of how screwed he would, how screwed he was, and I noticed that Zane was drawn in pen, and then Richard was more in that brush, style.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about your art choices?
Yeah, sure.
In this and how you came to it, because the first thing right away that I was struck with in the first few pages is that. Your pen work that you're doing in this looks, I mean, it's different than the other work that I'm familiar with you. And the real world stuff is more like that brushy, that brush and ink style that I've seen you do, like in Judge Dredd. So can you talk a little bit about these different muscles and stuff like that?
Well, one of the joys of 2080, I've worked for 2080 for about a decade now, over a decade, and one of the joys with it is that every strip tends to be quite short. And because every strip is quite short, you've got a huge amount of room to experiment. Matt Smith, the editor, is very kind. You know, generally what happens is I'll send Matt an email and say, Matt, is there anything, any work there? And he'll send me an email back saying, there's this, do you want to do this? And I'll go, great. And he'll say, here's your deadline. I'll go, okay. And then I'll send the artwork to him when it's done. And it'll get published. So there is no editorial interference at all. So sometimes what I'll do is, especially if it's a strip that isn't associated with anything, if it's something that's never been done by anyone else before. So you'll get these little sort of one-off Future Shock style stories or little one-off Dreads or whatever. And I'll go, do you know what? I'm going to draw this in this manner. And I'll deliberately make an aesthetic choice. I'll, for example, there's one strip I did where I kind of went, I'm going to draw it cartoony and I'm going to give it a single color tone. So it'll have black and white plus green. And then I'll do the entire strip like that for no other reason than I can. And I'll send it in to him and he'll go, great, that'll be published. And then the next time I get to do another strip, I'll go, I'll do this, right? How am I going to do this one? I'll draw this as though, and then I'll take another, in fact, the Dredd, I'm currently drawing Judge Dredd. And one thing I've always felt very strongly about is that you should try and avoid breaking panel borders. It should be something you don't do. Or if you are going to do it, make sure it's very sparingly used. Don't break every other panel border. Because what tends to happen is like Father. Have you ever seen Father Ted? You know Father Ted?
No,
you never seen Father. Oh my goodness, you see Father Ted. Anyway, Father Ted is a comedy series. But anyway, this is not because you don't know it. It's totally irrelevant. But Father Jack is one of the characters in it, and Father Jack is a notoriously drunken, sweary priest who swears all the time. And you say feck arse girls all the time. That's all he does. That's that character's entire drive. But which means that every time he swears, there's no effect. It's like it washes over you. Whereas when one of the other characters swears, one of the other characters who you don't expect to swear, they swear, then it has an impact. It jumps right out at you. And that's what breaking a panel border is like. If you do it all the time, it has no impact. But if you do it once in a while, then it has a big impact. But anyway, I don't really break panel borders. I try not to. And the Dredd that I'm doing at the moment, I took a deliberate decision. I thought, I'm going to break a panel border every single page. Just one. Doesn't matter what it is. I'm deliberately just one, just to do it. And then, of course, you start doing that. And by about the second or third episode of it, you're going, well, maybe this was a mistake. But, you make choices early on and then you have to live with them. With Number Cruncher, again, going back to that film, A Matter of Life and Death, it's a film I've always loved. And the process they used, as I say, in the afterlife was to use a kind of, I think they called it, it was a new process and they called it Techni. It was like Technicolor and then Technichrome was the process where they've essentially filmed it with Technicolor and then kind of reduced it down to a grey. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what I need to do is I want the real world stuff to be colour and the afterlife stuff to have this kind of grey wash effect. And I've used a grey wash before in 2008. I used it a few years ago, about 5, 6 or 7 years ago to draw a Rogue Trooper strip. And it worked for that. It worked really well for that. And I thought it would be interesting that the two art styles sitting together would be really interesting. But of course, because it wasn't going to be coloured, I thought, well, I need to make it more of a contrast. I can't just have a grey wash line art and then a normal line art. So then I made the decision to make the real world stuff more kind of much more sort of black and white and much more kind of Spartan than the grey wash stuff. Plus the other thing with it was that in the script really called for the afterlife to be this kind of chaotic world of things happening, numbers flying everywhere. Simon's he's both great and terrible for this, where he will describe to you a smell. You know, the character smells bad and you're kind of going, oh, I don't know, you know, I'm not sure. And he really leaves it to you to kind of fulfill it. But I mean, usually you rise to it and you kind of you sort of meet those kind of difficult instructions. You think, oh, I don't know. I want everything to have numbers and to look like a fractal. And you're thinking, what? Why? What? You want it to look like a fractal? I don't. Oh God. So oddly, the grey wash. I find when I use grey wash before, it has what I call value for money for an artist. It requires almost no effort, but actually looks very detailed, and people love it. You know, they love the effect it adds. So it seemed like a very kind of low maintenance way to add an extra layer of detail to everything that was doing. And the numbers as well, with the numbers that are flying around in it, I built a brush in Photoshop. So a lot of the artwork has, there's things that are drawn on the page and then a grey wash applied to them, scanned into the computer, and then I added extra layers of numbers flying off everywhere. You'll see Zane's cigarette as he's walking around smoking it. It's emitting little numbers out of it.
Yeah, I saw that I think it was like the first or the second page.
Yeah. So you know, and these are all sort of, and as people get injured from the afterlife, you'll see that instead of really bleeding blood, they start bleeding numbers out of them. So it's you know, but these are descriptions that Simon kind of writes down, and you think, I don't know how to draw that, Simon. Oh God, I've got to do it now. So I mean, it was partly inspiration, partly desperation. That's how I came to the art style within it. Which is how all the best things happen.
I mean, it's working really well. Another thing, you know, in comparing the two worlds that you're creating in this story, I can't tell if it's just the difference from the tools you're using, but I sort of feel like in the afterlife, at times you're almost using more of like a cartoonist's shorthand, whereas in the real world it's a little more rendered. I'm thinking specifically of the page where they're first... where you first introduce Richard and Jessica, and the hands in the afterlife are a little more like.
I think that's one of those things where one of my, I think we all work within our limitations, and I have to be honest, I much prefer cartooning, and I think it's when I cartoon, I think I get very, things become very expressive and great, but I'm always worried that readers don't buy cartooning, you know, that readers don't sort of buy into it, and that they're, so I'm always a little afraid that if I go too over the top with the cartoony, then it becomes difficult. And then you're right in that especially in the afterlife, these characters lend themselves to cartoony. Mm-hmm. The bastard Zane and the accountant lend themselves to kind of a gnarly cartoony art style. And then Richard Time, who in some respects, and again, what you've got to remember is when I was first drawing this, I had 8 pages of a script for 1 month, and then the next month another 8 pages, and then another 8 pages. So I didn't really know. You know more about the first episode than I knew about the first episode when I drew the first few pages. So there are characters that I kind of thought, this character dies in the first couple of pages, so I'll not really spend too long designing him. And then you realize that, oh, okay, so he's actually the other protagonist. There are 2 protagonists and he's one of them. Oh no, I haven't spent any time designing this character. So I think you're right. I mean, as it goes on, it maybe evolves to a wee bit more. I get a little braver with the cartoony faces in the real world. There's a scene in I think episode 2 in the first couple of pages where there's a number of sort of people by the farm, as it were, and they're very cartoony. The death scene is very cartoony. I think I was trying to take a lot of my cues from how Simon had written some of it, and some of it struck me as very obviously square in the middle of a caricature kind of individuals. So I kind of wish I'd gone and made them all a little bit more cartoony. On the other hand, maybe the kind of the cartoony for the afterlife and the real world adds another layer of contrast to them, which is no bad thing necessarily.
No, I mean that's how I took it.
Yeah. Okay, in that case, that's exactly what I intended. It's certainly not in any way, shape, or form a limitation of my own ability.
Well, you know, I'm a huge fan of cartooning and cartoonists,
yeah.
You know, and I really, like, when I see artists becoming very, very gestural, very, you know, like, boiling down what's on the page to the essence, you know, like, to all you need to convey that this is that and this is that.
Yeah.
I really appreciate those things.
Well, I've always loved cartooning, but I've always been, and this is one of those things that there is no manual for a comic book career. There's no good guideline. There's a kind of, you know, there's how to draw comics the Marvel way, and then there's, you know, there's lots of advice about how to break in, but there's no good book that says, now you've successfully had your first gig, here is how your career should progress.
Mm-hmm.
Now here are the things you should avoid, and here's the things you should do. There is no guide like that. So I spend half my time kind of going, oh, do you know what, I'm going to draw, the heck with it, I'm just going to draw this the way I want. And then the other half going, oh, maybe the editor is not going to like this. Maybe I should be drawing it in this way because this is the way they expect. Oh no, I don't know what I'm doing. So there's a lot of that goes on. I think as I've gotten older, I've gotten a little bit braver. I mean, oddly as well, I the very first, I suppose you could call it professionally published work I did was for Fantagraphics, and it was a comic strip called Holy Cross, and it was about 1994, and it was very, very cartoony, and it was a style I'd never really used before, and it was a very super cartoony art style, and looking back on that, that holds up a lot better than my realistic stuff. You know, my realistic stuff. Yeah, I mean, from that time period, and I think it's because I'm a cartoonist who's fighting it. I'm always fighting against it and trying to draw more realistically, you know, trying to draw in the art style of you know, trying to, oh God, if only I could be Adam Hughes. Oh God, if only I could do that. And then you kind of, and you go, no, I'm much more like John McRae, or, you know, who I love. Good, John's a friend of mine. And when I was about 18 or 19, I used to hang around out at his house, and we'd draw stuff together. So sometimes you'll see a John McRae influence in my art. But there's always that worry, you go too far cartoony, and then people go, wow, this dread. Oh no, that's, well, why is he drawing it like that? That's weird. So that's, but I think all artists are like that. All artists are always worried. You know, there's always that concern that, especially when someone actually goes, I'll pay you to draw some comics, please. And you go, brilliant. No, I don't draw anything like how you've seen all my other work, by the way. That's, you know, you never want to say, you want to go, yeah, I'll draw exactly whatever way you tell me to draw is the way I'm going to draw. And they go, just whatever makes you happy. And you're going, oh, no, now I've got to second guess everything. So you're always sort of second guessing stuff. But that's, you know, it's, I think only when you've had some success with certain things that, and you've had feedback and, you know, I mean, there's still now occasionally an uncomfortable mix between reality and cartoony in some of my work. And it's one of the things I love about drawing Judge Dredd, oddly, is that Dredd can straddle cartoony and realism within the same panel quite comfortably.
Yeah.
Judge Dredd as a character can be very grim and realistic, and then everything around him can look like a Looney Tunes cartoon. You know, it's a character that allows you to do that. And I think Zane allows that as well. Zane's a character that allows a cartooniness around him, and then sort of realism around everything else.
You mentioned second guessing. You know, Number Cruncher being a strip that has already run, is it difficult to sit on it, knowing that it's going to be republished? Like, is there a part of you that's just like, I have time to redraw every page? How do you look at your old work?
I it was long enough ago, I think, that, I mean, I'm going to have to go in. There are pages that I have to read. No, there's elements I'm redrawn, and then there are pages that we're adding to the second and third issue. And the first issue has a new page, page one, which is sort of has the real world bleeding into the kind of Number Cruncher world. That's an entirely new page. So there's that kind of thing. You're going, oh, right, I don't really remember how I drew. I mean, especially for me, I like to experiment a bit and I like to change my art style as I go. And I think because of that, I hope I'm learning constantly. I certainly feel like I know less and less every time. But, it means then when you get some distance, you look back at it and you think, hey, some of that was much better than I thought it was. Also, I don't know how to draw like that anymore. So there's a concern when I go back to do some of these pages. I'm going to be fighting and they're going to look weirdly out of, they're just going to look wrong together. I hope not. Hopefully not. I haven't really been tempted to go back and redraw. I think I'm normally very good at once the door's closed on a page, I kind of move on from it. What's going to be difficult for me, I think, is seeing any kind of, when you read the reviews and so on and any negative criticism. Although, touch wood, so far it's all been great. But any negative criticism on the artwork, I'll look at it and go, yeah, you think that, but that was drawn 2 years ago, so I don't care. it's you've moved on so far that you're hopefully drawn differently anyway.
Yeah.
It is going to be funny going back and cause as I say, there are pages and bits and pieces I'm going to have to redraw, but I'm not overly tempted. I think any time I'd be tempted to change a page isn't about the quality of the art so much as it's about the quality of the storytelling. And I think if the storytelling lets it down, that would be something I definitely want to change. But I think, and I might be wrong, and this is for other people to judge, I think generally my storytelling is quite good. I think even in a complicated story like that Number Cruncher, generally it's very straightforward to read, and you can tell what's happening, and I've made storytelling decisions that I think play out okay. Yeah. So I could certainly go in and tweak all the artwork and improve it and so on, but I wouldn't really change the storytelling. And I think there comes a point where it doesn't matter if you make it 10 times better, no one's going to notice. Because people are hopefully reading it for the story, and without wanting to sound like a big wanker, I am a storyteller first and an artist second. It's the storytelling is the important bit for me, especially in a story. I mean, I don't get to collaborate with. I mean, Simon will very kindly say that, oh, this is me and PJ 50-50 and blah blah blah. But really, this is Simon's story. I have just drawn it. I grant that I've contributed character designs and so on, but it is Simon's story. I've visioned it and told that story. So as far as I'm concerned, the telling of it, if the telling of it works, then it doesn't matter that much if some of the drawing isn't as strong as some of the other drawings that I can do now. It's just one of those things you just have to live with, I think.
I think that's probably the cartoonist in you speaking too.
That's the other thing with cartoony stuff. It's sort of, you do a cartoony thing and you think, could I make that funnier? Could I stretch that a wee bit? But, generally, move on and go on to the next thing. That's always been my motto as far as drawing comics is concerned. Finish it and move on. Because I've certainly been down this road where you can spend months redrawing the same two or three pages and you never get anything finished, and you end up with like two or three pages that are 50% better drawn than they were 3 months previously. But who's going to know? No one. It's a quickest way to madness.
And please, I wasn't calling into question the quality of the art or anything. I think the pages look wonderful in this. But I know it's a tendency that creatives can have.
You're absolutely right. I kind of feel like there's no single artist in the world at any point in their career ever has looked at something they've drawn and gone, that's about perfect now. I can finish. I'm done. And those few people that have done that have generally been very self-deluded. I wouldn't want to mention any names, but they're the sorts of people that you would look at their artwork and go, wow, he really thinks he's done a good job on that. That's madness. I'm fond of telling the idea, mentioning the idea that what kept Leonardo da Vinci awake at night was thinking that Michelangelo is out there drawing better than him, and what kept Michelangelo awake at night was the thoughts that da Vinci's doing stuff even better than him. And there's this constant thing with all artists that every new work is good enough, really. But the important thing isn't whether it's good enough. The important thing is whether you've finished the damn thing and moved on to the next thing. That's my feeling anyway. So there's definitely not perfection in that in the artwork. But some of it's, you know, I think the storytelling is good, and I think it does the job that it needs to do. And I think there are some great fun bits of artwork in it that I really, even now I look at and I think, yeah, that's quite fun. Technically could draw them better, but I think they're fun and they don't need to be, you know, you don't need to, I think you can kill artwork sometimes by redrawing and removing all of the kind of movement out of it. On the idea that you're going to make the arm look a little bit better, mm-hmm. You know,
it becomes too massaged.
Yeah, and you kind of and sometimes as well the thing with artwork is it's the flaws that make it. You know, it's the flaws that give it the personality. I can't remember who said it, but somebody said that your art style is all the stuff that you draw wrong. You know, you take away all the flaws from it, what you're left with is something with no personality at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope there's personality in my artwork, which is to say there's a shitload of flaws in it.
can you tell us a little bit about the dread strip that you're working on now? Is this going to be like one of the like a one-off story, or is it going to go on through a couple progs?
It's a six issue thing, so six episodes to it, and it's a follow up to another thing I did that had seven episodes. So it's a sort of it's one of those with Mike Carroll, who is currently writing, I think, Jennifer Blood, mm-hmm. for Dynamo. And I've known Mike years as well, and it's a character that we've worked with before in Dredd's universe, and it feels nice. It feels like it's my own little pocket universe of Dredd that I can go into and draw. And in some respects, there is kind of every artist gets to the opportunity to build their own version of Dredd's world, their own version of Dredd, and their own version of Dredd's bike, and their own version of Dredd's gun, and their own version of the sorts of citizens around Dredd's world. And so it's nice to go in and kind of refine that every time and massage it to it until it's kind of, I mean, my version of Dredd's world tends to be populated with goofy looking characters with big noses and slightly rotund bodies and stuff. This is part of the Chaos Day arc, which was kind of destroyed most of Mega City 1, and this is about a bunch of cadets that are on the run, and Dredd's sort of hunting, tracking them down. So Dredd's always a joy to draw. I had a little, there's a little sort of artistic hiccup there for a couple of months, and I got this gig drawing Dredd, and as soon as I started drawing the Dredd, it was kind of everything was back in, the world was at peace with itself. And my wife came in. I've been with my wife for about 18 years now, mm-hmm. Which means she has known me for my professional comic drawing career has been 10 years, but she has known me since before that. And I'd be sitting there drawing Dredd, and she'll come into the room and she'll go, "You're drawing Dredd?" I'll go, "Yeah." She says, "Does that not make you just really happy knowing that that's what you're doing?" I go, "Yes, it does." It's the greatest thing in the world. And so it's funny because I always read, about guys doing, I don't know if you saw the, God, what's his name, the Disney artist who retired. He posted.
He did all the Duck books.
Yeah, he did all the Duck books. I can't remember who it is. But
I'm losing credibility.
Well, I will Google that for you. No, let's not say I'm Googling. You can edit that bit out, can't you? Disney Duck. Don Rosa, is it?
Yes.
I haven't even got that. Yeah, it's Don Rosa. Because I Googled it and all I've got is Carl Barks, but it's Don Rosa. he posted basically saying that he's retired from drawing comics and that, you know, he had such joy drawing the Carl Barks Disney Duck books, mm-hmm. and that was the only thing he wanted to draw. You're reading it and you're going, why didn't you go and do other things? Don't do the Disney. Go and do, you could. There are publishers that would be willing to pay him vast amounts of money to draw anything else. But no, I want to be a slave to the Disney Donald Duck stuff. And you're thinking, that's madness. And then you kind of realize that, well, I'm a bit like that with Dredd. It's, you know, Dredd is the thing I've always loved. It's the thing that I remember when I was about 8 or 9 years old, and my uncle, and I don't want this to reflect, I'm not going to say the year, but let's put it like this. Me and my uncle built a Justice One, which was Judge Dredd's deep space ship. And we built it out of computer punch cards. Now, I'm not saying it was a long time ago. But I don't even know if people know what punch cards are anymore. So we had, all these punch cards, and we built this Justice One spaceship out of it when I was 8 or 9 or something. And so I've always loved Judge Dredd. So the getting to, I think the first 2000 AD work I ever did was drawing Judge Dredd professionally, and it was such a shock for me to finally live that dream that I kind of didn't really know what to do then for a good few years. I was kind of wandering around going, I don't know where to take my comic book career because I seem to have peaked already. I've peaked on my first go, and now I don't know where to go with this. I don't know where I'm going now. But you sort of, you build new ambitions and so on, but it's still always a joy to get to do some Dredd. I think now I've gotten to the point where my Dredd is recognisably my Dredd, and that he has a certain, I hesitate to use the word, I'll not use the word, but other artists have their version of Dredd, which are often called their classic Dredds. Jock Audley has done very little Dredd, but his Dredd was instantly a classic looking Dredd. Boland has a classic Dredd. Mike mm-hmm. McMahon has a classic Dredd. Steve Dillon drew Dredd for a few years, and Steve Dillon was always the Dredd that I loved. And I kind of feel like I'm getting to the stage where I've got my own, I've got my own version of Dredd that looks different from all the other versions of Dredd, and yet at the same time is sort of perfectly Dredd. So it's nice to, it's taken me 10 years to get to there, but it's one of the frustrations of seeing American artists draw Dredd is that they haven't grown up with the character, so they always get something slightly not quite right, and it's like one of those there's a great, I think it's an Outer Limits story where a character wakes up one day and the word for dog is the word dinosaur. And that's, the universe has changed ever so slightly, uh-huh. and he has to relearn how to read. His daughter teaches him, D is for apple. It's that, it's everything in the world. All the words in the world start changing, and it's a bit like that. Every time I see an American Dredd, I kind of go, "Wow, that looks really." Oh no, there's something slightly odd about that. What is it? you can't quite put your finger on it. There's always something that's because they haven't grown up with the character. But it's the same, I suppose. If Captain America and all those other sort of American superhero characters don't have anywhere near the meaning for me that Dredd does.
Yeah.
But Dredd's an unusual character. I mean, Dredd, when I started reading Dredd from Probe 2, 1977, the character's storyline has never been rebooted. This is not like Spider-Man. It's not, it's not, or Batman, and it's not like any of those things where there's been a reboot and now we're back to year one. It's moved from 1977 to now. That's one continuous story, effectively.
Yeah, and so Dredd is in his 60s now, isn't he?
I saw a thing saying that Dredd was about 73, they reckon, wow. roughly. But I mean, you've got to remember, he's got robotic eyes, he's got paper lungs, he's not fully human anymore. Yeah. I'm not even convinced he's got a top of his head. I've never certainly the way I draw Dredd, it looks like Dredd's helmet is screwed on. Yeah. It's just like a bulb that screws in place. So because there's never quite enough room for the top of his head. That man is mostly chin and helmet. That's the way of him. So yeah, he's about 73, but he's a sprightly 73. I would say that given the nature of the sci-fi world that Dredd lives in, there's a good 20 or 30 years left in him before they have to really worry about what are we going to do with 85-year-old Judge Dredd. Uh-huh. But then, at some point that will come. They'll have to figure that out.
Have you had the chance to see the IDW Judge Dredd that they've been printing?
I've read the first issue of it. That's been about it. It's an odd one because it's sort of I was talking about this before. Dredd works for the UK mm-hmm. because of very specific things. Dredd, I have this theory about, and please don't be offended. I hope I don't offend anyone.
Please share.
But I have this theory about America and Americans, and that the theory essentially is that all of your ancestors, all of your family at some point took one look around them and went, bloody hell, this place we're living in is a shithole. Let's move to America, right? And all of my ancestors took one look around them and went, bloody hell, this place is a shithole. Oh, well, we'd better stay here. So you've got these two totally self-selected groups that one set of them is always on the outlook for something better. There's always going to be something better on, over the horizon. We'll take that gamble. We'll take that risk. And which is why I think Americans love people who try. They don't care if they fail. They love people who try. Whereas in the UK, what tends to happen is we all took one look at everyone that went to America and went, well, it's going to go wrong for them, isn't it? We're going to stay here in the wet. And just kind of, you know, we'll have our national health service because what else are we going to do? We're all going to die anyway, so we might as well do something about that. So it's this very different sort of attitude. So I think the people, it's that phrase that we're two people separated by a common language. I think there's humor. There's elements of humor that doesn't carry very well to America, and there's stuff in America that doesn't carry very well here. And I think the upshot is that. Most Americans are very optimistic. There's an optimism about America, about how great everything can be, and if we only have a go. And then there's a pessimism in the UK, which is sort of amounts to it doesn't matter what you do, everything's going to be bloody awful. And that sort of attitude is so ingrained in the people that it's one of the reasons why Dredd as a character works for us really well. I mean, your idea of a superhero is, your idea of a super character or a hero is Captain America, and our idea of a character is this fascist policeman who beats people up for crossing the road. You know, that's kind of, you know, there's, so I kind of think that I think it's one of the reasons before 2000 AD have in the past lifted Dredd and taken it over to America, and he just hasn't traveled well at all. And I think it's because of that. I think the mistake is thinking that Dredd doesn't travel well because there's something about America we can't quite unlock. To me, it's dead obvious. It's a very different culture, and it's a very different sort of set of driving dynamics that underlie the people's motivations and stuff. So I always think that if you can get a Judge Dredd that works brilliantly in America, he wouldn't necessarily work at all in the UK. You know, so I can, for that reason, I don't even want to approach thinking critically about the Judge Dredd American comic, because I think if I approach it from a UK reader's point of view, I'll inevitably go, well, you know, there's this problem and that problem and the other problem, but the thing is, I can't approach it from an American point of view because I'm not wired that way. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not wired for that sort of optimism. I'm wired for that kind of pessimism. I'm wired for failure, is what I'm saying, Mike. It's a thing that almost all of us are in the UK. We're all wired for failure, which is to say why we have a health service, because we fully expect to die of something. Whereas Americans are kind of, you know what, we're all going to be healthy forever.
Yeah, we're fucking immortal.
Yeah, we're immortal. Everything's going to be great, you know. And whereas in the UK, we're all thinking we're all going to be dead. Something's terrible. We're all going to catch some terrible, terrible infection and die. So we need some sort of national health service. That's why I think Dredd doesn't work in America.
I feel like my thinking on why Dredd doesn't seem to catch on in America, and it's different from yours in that I feel like it's too spot on. Like,
well, Dredd, I think that, you know, the basic description of Dredd is that Dredd is a satire of everything that goes on in America.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, which is a good explanation of him in the early days. You know, a lot of stuff that happened in Dredd would have been sort of satirical stuff that happened in America. But then, you know, that stuff then happens over here. So, for example, in early Dredd, you know, the idea of smoking being banned except for certain smokatoriums, mm-hmm. was satire. I mean, now it's happened. Now smoking, yeah, is banned. You can't go anywhere to smoke. I don't smoke, but that, you know, so there are, and in Dredd's world, there were competitive eating contests because that was the UK looking at America saying, you know, if America keeps going the way it's going, it's going to have competitive eating contests. And of course, there are now competitive eating contests. So, you know, in some respects, the satire element of it, there's no way to overplay it. It's been done. I mean, a really common trope in Dredd's comics in 2000 AD is the idea of a sort of a fad, the idea of this suddenly every character does, you know, wears boing boing, which is a great sort of ball of plastic they bounce around everywhere in, and there have pinball machines, and these inevitably lead to some disastrous consequence, and Dredd basically steps in and shoots someone in the head, fixing everything. But that's kind of, again, that's the UK looking at America and going, well, you know what? Americans are always going crazy for hula hoops or crazy for this or crazy for that sort of thing. But then we sort of do that now as well. So there's a sort of that element of it, that satirical element is almost complete. I mean, we have, I honest to goodness, I can't, there's a TV program on ITV, which is competitive, which is diving. It's called Splash, and it's celebrities diving into pools. That's a diving TV program. That's a real thing that's really on TV in the UK. Now, that 10 years ago, that would have been a satirical Judge Dredd strip about ridiculous some TV in America is, but that's what we've got now on TV in the UK. So I don't know. I mean, things are changing. I think my kind of general sweeping statement about the difference between Americans and people from the UK is, you know, it's nonsense, obviously, but it's a sweeping statement, and there are obviously people who will get it. And I kind of wonder if the Dredd movie is going to make a difference. I mean, I thought the Dredd movie was hilarious. It was very funny. And well, that's it. I don't know if most people looking at it will think it was funny,
because
but I think the people that do think it was funny are going to get Judge Dredd the comic, because it was so perfectly, you know, there are elements of that movie that for example, there's a great line right at the start where Dredd, where the chief judge says to Judge Dredd, take Judge Anderson, she needs to be tested, and throw her into the deep end. And Dredd just looks around and goes, it's all deep end.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, oh, that's an hilarious line. That's very funny. It's so perfectly, it's such a perfect line that Dredd would say in the comic. And there's another line right at the end where just after all the manic, you know, all the shooting and the death and the blowing things up, and, you know, Dredd's nearly been sort of destroyed from the cannon fire and stuff. And again, the chief judge says, what happened? And he goes, drugs bust, the perps were uncooperative.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. It's funny when people think that's funny. I don't understand. You know, that's sort of underplayed kind of.
Yeah.
That's a great sort of element of Dredd's world as well. That sort of element of humor. So as say, I mean, the other thing about the Dredd, the IDW Dredd comics, I'd love to work on it. So I can't say anything critical at all. You know, I love drawing Dredd. If an American said, you can draw Dredd for us, I would go, cool. So, so there.
But I would love to see. Oh, I'm sorry. Go on.
Oh, it's been interesting seeing big name artists take a sort of kind of swipe at drawing Judge Dredd. I feel like a lot of them miss it. I feel like they don't quite get it. They don't quite get the character.
Yeah,
and I've
I
seen
would agree.
The some of the covers by. But the weird thing is, I don't know if the actual audience for the Dredd comic in America notice or would care. You know, for me, it all feels slightly wrong, like a universe where Spock has a goatee. It's sort of, you know something's not right.
Yeah.
you know it's not quite the right place. You know you're in some sort of evil alternative world, but you can't quite figure out what it is that's different. But having said that, I've seen some of the covers by Greg Staples, and the fully painted ones painted by a guy called Ryan Brown, who's from Belfast, and they are beautiful. I mean, they're so just gorgeous looking, brilliant pieces of Dredd, and you kind of think, well, my worry is that the audience for an IDW Dredd will look at them and go, well, here's a Dredd cover by Joe Starlin's not right, is it? That's right. Is that the right name?
I think it's the right name, but I don't think it's right in this situation.
Well, he did, didn't he? Do Mike? No, there's definitely one by, oh goodness, what's his name? Famous American one, the American artist that did writer artist that did very famous for his filthy comics. Oh God, what's his name?
Oh, I don't know.
He did Dredd crashing on a bike through a window. This is terrible. I keep saying names and not remembering people's names. There's Dredd's crashing through a bike, and there's bits of it, and you go, that's not. Well, it's nice. It's interesting that he's done that. It's interesting seeing him do that, but it's not quite right. But it is weird, because it doesn't matter how big a name they are. I've seen a John Romita Jr. cover, which wasn't quite right again. And you think, why can they not get it quite right? What is? Because the weird thing about Dredd is he's so malleable as a character. There's so many different ways you can draw him, and they're all right. And yet somehow they find the thing to tweak that's just slightly wrong.
Well,
it's like the helmet. Is quite right.
I feel like a lot of American artists draw him too much, like with a Superman body.
I suppose if you haven't drawn, I mean, I've grown up with the character and I've seen him drawn every single possible way. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way I tend to draw him now is very imposing. I mean, to me, Dredd is very powerful when he's not on frame. Dredd would have overpower a panel. You know, if you have Dredd in there, all you need is his chin. You don't need any more than that to suggest Judge Dredd is looking very, very annoyed. Mm-hmm. You know, that's all you need is his chin and a bit of the helmet. Whereas I think maybe some of the American guys treat him as a superhero and draw him as a superhero. You know, Dredd's the hero of this strip, so Dredd would stand there with his hands on his hips looking superheroic, you know, thing. And he's not, you know, I did a page a few years ago where Dredd's hunting down this kind of dragon in the cursed earth. It's this sort of mutant dragon thing, and there's an element of the story where Dredd stumbles across, he's, you know, the dragon's breathing fire, and he realizes what armor he's got isn't going to be enough, so he stumbles across this cache of litter, and he builds for himself a suit of armor, and by accident it looks like a knight's armor. So, you know, he's got all these elements and he's holding a lance and he's standing there. And the real temptation is to draw it like he's posing. Mm-hmm. Like he's posing for a painting of a knight about to slay a dragon. That's the temptation. But in the story, he doesn't realize he looks like a knight. In the story, he's just put all this stuff on. So I drew it as though I've just put this on, I'm standing here with this. And it sort of works. I mean, it works because that's the way the storytelling is. But I kind of can't help feeling that an American artist or, you know, well, to be honest, even I, you're half tempted to draw it mm-hmm. as though it's a superheroic pose. But part of the story is that he doesn't realize what he looks like. And the moment you pose him as if he realizes what he looks like, it becomes a different character. Dredd essentially doesn't care what he looks like. He's getting on with the job and doing the job, you know. So he looks cool just by virtue of looking cool. He's a cool looking dude.
Yeah, he's a badass
He's a badass looking dude. He's not a guy you want to mess with, that's for sure. He's not someone you want to be your friend.
No.
Dredd's one of those people. I think we've all met people like this in real life where you think, that guy really, you know, that guy's really interesting. That guy's really sort of, you know, but I don't want to be friends with that guy because they scare me.
Yeah. Dredd would be a terrible friend.
He would be an awful friend. not someone you want to hang around with, that's for sure.
did you happen to see James Herron's Judge Dredd that he did?
Yeah, I really loved that. I mean, James didn't quite, I don't think he quite, I think another couple of goes at Dredd and he'd get Dredd perfectly, but I think in terms of everything else, it was great. He drew Dredd looking slightly monkeyish, slightly like a gorilla, and which was kind of, it was an interesting choice. I mean, Guy Davis did a Dredd with because I know Rob really well. I chat to Rob all the time, and Rob's always trying to get in some of these guys. And oddly, I mean, the thing is, James Herron isn't the guy you associate with superhero stuff.
No.
At least not the guy I associate with superhero stuff. And Guy Davis is another guy who did a Dredd strip, and his Dredd was spot on. Absolutely perfect.
I still haven't seen it.
Oh, have you not? It's great. Wow. It's really good.
I love his stuff. Like, I love BPRD. Yeah.
He's in the Judge Dredd magazine, and you could probably buy that as a digital download from 2080's website. So if you dig through that, you might find that if you want to see it. But it's a beautiful looking Dredd strip, beautifully coloured as well, and it's kind of and again Dredd's not quite 100% away there, but it's one of those odd things where they tweak the uniform just in the wrong bits. It's like there's some bits you can tweak right and some bits you can tweak wrong. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of fascinating to see. But aside from that, it's great looking, you know. Maybe I'm just overly fussy. Maybe it's the problems of me. No artist can draw Dredd like me and Brian Boland and Mike McMahon. And that's it. We're the only three ever allowed to draw Judge Dredd.
Who's your favorite Dredd artist?
Do you know, if I'm honest, I have two favorites. One now, if I look back over the Dredds, I mean, it's always nice to see. One nice thing about Dredd is seeing how different guys draw Dredd. But when I was younger, it was Steve Dillon who drew Dredd for a few years. Mm-hmm. Back when, you know, he famously drew a Dredd werewolf story called, what's it called, Lair of the White Werewolf or something. It's one of those great Dredd stories were written by John Wagner and Alan Grant, where, you know, Dredd goes off on an unusual mission, and at the end of it, Dredd makes a terrible, terrible joke. Because the rumor is that what used to happen was John and Alan would write a Dredd story, and they'd plot out the beginning of it and the middle of it, and they'd never really think about the end until they got bored with the story and then just cut it dead, and it would just be over, and they'd go, "What are we going to do with the end of this?" And then they come up with a line. So in this story, what happens is these werewolves are in the Undercity, which is sort of Megacity One is built on top of all of the remains of New York and various other cities. And where Dredd is at the moment, the Undercity is kind of still sort of exists. It's these crushed buildings and you know, people live under there, mutants and stuff. It's not unlike the Futurama episodes.
Where they go to old New York.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so this werewolf comes out of the Undercity and infects a passerby, and then Dredd takes him down, and they realize that there's this sort of werewolf population somehow, and that Dredd needs to go in and find him. So Dredd goes onto the city, and he finds a white werewolf who turns out to be the source of this infection. And in the process of fighting him, Dredd gets bitten. And then it's just this really classic bit where Dredd's ripping his uniform off as he's turned into a werewolf, and he gets out of the city, and he finally gets Dredd, sort of as he's killed the white werewolf and all the other werewolves, he escapes, but he's escaped as a werewolf. And the what happens then is the judges subdue him, and they give him the antidote, because by this stage they've worked out what the antidote's going to be, and they give him the antidote, and one of the judges goes to Dredd, "So Dredd, what was it like down there?" And Dredd goes, "I don't mind telling you, it got a bit hairy." And you just, that's a terrible, terrible joke. It's an awful joke, you know. But I met Steve Dillon a couple of times, and this was years ago. We were talking in a bar in Belfast, and he was saying, I remember doing that story, the white werewolf, and having to draw those fucking hairs on the werewolves with a wee brush, and it was a really hot summer that year, and my girlfriend was out in the other room, and I was sweating drawing these little tiny hairs on these werewolves. And you're thinking, wow, he's talking about a comic I read when I was 7. That's awesome.
Hilarious.
So, you know, so Steve Dillon was always the main guy. But you get older and your tastes change, and there are other guys like Mike McMahon, who's an artist that sort of has really changed and evolved his art style over the years. And you find with a lot of people, they go, "Oh, this is my favourite McMahon period," because he has different periods of art styles. And you know, his Dredd is a sort of definitive classic Dredd. You know, I've always admired Bolan's Dredd, but I've never loved it. Mm. But, you know, it's always felt a little cold to me. And then, you know, in the modern era, there's a lot of good guys. And, you know, Andrew Curry's just done a Dredd there fairly recently. And who's did it for him? But, you know, I mean, 2080, I think, has been on a high for a few years, actually. It's one of the great shames of it is that it doesn't sell the same numbers that it did in the mid-90s when it was awful. But it, you know, and now it's brilliant, and it doesn't sell anywhere near the numbers in the mid-90s, which is a shame, but there it is.
Something, you know, you touched on something there that I'm curious about. You know, what in the UK, what is 2000 AD and Judge Dredd like? You know, like, before we started recording, I sort of compared it to, like, where I was wondering if Dredd is to you what Batman is to me, you know, a character I've grown up with and is part of popular culture.
I think it's different. Like, I think one of the things that really is different about Dredd is that the vast majority of people that read Dredd have grown up with it. Mm-hmm. And I mean that in every sense. I mean, they have read Dredd from they were a young child, and Dredd as a character has got more and more complicated and has gotten older with them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are, you know, the stories from when I was 10 or 11 are stories pitched to 10 or 11-year-olds. The stories that are out now are sort of pitched to a much more adult reader. And I think at the time, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, when 2000 AD was out there, we didn't have as many comics. We didn't have as many characters as Batman, and you know, there was no Batman, Superman, all those other characters. And in terms of iconic British characters, there was Judge Dredd. The British comics industry in the 70s and 80s was sort of dominated by humor comics and war comics. And all of those fell to the wayside, leaving essentially just 2000 AD. And the comic industry now in the UK is made up of pretty much 2000 AD and Panini, who I think it's Panini who do all of the Marvel reprints, mm-hmm. and a whole bunch of kids comics, which are all sort of, you know, they have comic strips like the, you know, like kids TV stuff that's on there, and the Beano, which has been going from the 30s. But in terms of action hero stuff, it's only ever been Judge Dredd. So anybody who's ever read comics and is in their, you know, 30s to 40s would have read Dredd. Everyone would have done in the UK, I think. And so it's I think at once it's a different. I mean, it's difficult to compare. It's like, you know, it's like saying to me, you know, you're 5'4". What do you think it's like for someone who's 6'3"? It's kind of. I can only tell you what it's like for me, and everything seems to be perfectly normal. You know, I imagine if you were 6'3", you'd wonder why everything's so far down. Yeah. You know, it's like that. I can only ever see it from my perspective. So for me, Dredd, I mean, for me personally, Dredd has always been part of my life. And you know, even those periods where I stopped reading comics, which you do as you get older, you stop reading them. I would still draw Judge Dredd. In fact, I've sketchbooks. I have a sketchbook which I bought and I kept, which says on the first page, "I will not draw Judge Dredd in this sketchbook." Page 2, a drawing of Judge Dredd. You know, it's like that. I mean, a mark of it is that in, I think, 1995, when the original Judge Dredd movie came out, I was in Milton Keynes in England. Milton Keynes is this kind of, do you know the town that the office is set in?
Yeah.
It's that kind of nondescript nowhere place.
Okay.
You know, it's that kind of, you know, so I was working there for the Open University doing computer programming, and Judge Dredd the movie came out, and it's a terrible movie, but I still went to see it twice in the cinema because it was Judge Dredd, and you know, and that was the closest thing to Judge Dredd I was getting. So I think I don't know. Once he's closer to your heart, at the same time, he's a completely different kind of character. So it's very hard to know. And also, I mean, I don't know. Batman. I don't think any single character in the pantheon of American comics has covered as many genres as Dredd had.
Yeah.
Has, you know, there's westerns, sci-fi, comedy. You know, there's every possible genre has been covered by Dredd just by the nature, because, you know, as often said, it's, you know, the story, Dredd is this sort of unmovable rock at the center of every single story. But the stories themselves are can be about anything, you know, and some of my favorite stories have been sort of comedy strips. I did a story called Meet the Flukes about a family of psychics who don't know they're psychic, and they can answer any question, but only on quiz shows. So they keep going on quiz shows and winning, and Dredd discovers that the reason that they're winning all the time is because they're psychic. So the Justice Department sets up a special sort of quiz show for them to ask them the whereabouts of various criminals, and then starts giving prizes. So, you know, I think with Batman, it's maybe possible. I mean, obviously there have been the Batman Brave and the Bold is a comedy thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Dark Knight Returns is a very different beast, although the Dark Knight Returns is also a comedy, really. But the Batman films are a different kind of more serious beast. But I think with a character like Batman, you have to establish that the entire universe is like this. And then that's all you're going to get. If you're going to get the Brave and the Bold kind of stories in the Brave and the Bold, that's all you'll get. You're not going to get one of those stories crashing into the Batman movie. You know, it's the Batman movie is a different beast. With Dredd, you know, one week you'll get a comedy story, the next week you'll get a serious story. So it's a different thing. It's, you know, I wish I could say for you, well, the closest thing to Judge Dredd is probably Batman mixed with Superman or Justice League of America, but it's a very different beast. I mean, our guy is essentially the bad guy.
Yeah.
He's the fascist cop that makes the law and enforces it with a gun, and happily. I mean, that's the other thing. When I was 7 or 8, the amount of violence in Judge Dredd as a comic strip was massive. There were things exploding everywhere and people being decapitated, and literally, I think the very first strip is Dredd shooting somebody for jaywalking, and he fires off a heat seeker and it shoots him in the back, and you can see them going ah as they die. And that's not an element you'll get in Superman, I don't think.
Now, what about in terms of like cultural popularity? Like, I could walk outside of my building right now and show someone a picture of Superman, and they will go, "Oh, Superman." Is it the same with Dredd over there?
No, it's not. It's not really. I think the Dredd movie helped, but I think in terms of a wider sort of cultural understanding, I think if you find someone who knows Dredd, they will love him, and otherwise they won't have a notion who you're talking about. And it could be, you might meet 10 people and one of them will know who Judge Dredd is, and they, I used to read 2000 AD when I was, this age or that age. So it's, in terms of a wider kind of cultural thing, he's pretty much unknown unless you know who he is, in which case you love him. Okay. To know him is to love him, I think, in some crazy way. But as a rule, I think most people don't know who he is. I think now they know a little bit about him because of the movie and stuff. But you generally find that if you mention Dredd, you'll either get something like, "Oh, my husband used to collect those," or you'll get, I don't know who you're talking about, or you'll get someone going, "Oh my God, new draw Judge Dredd. That's the most amazing. That's awesome. I used to love that." So that's the kind of people either know who you are and what you do, or they don't have a clue who you are. You could be anyone. That's in terms of being an artist for Judge Dredd. That's if someone says, "What do you do?" I always go, "I'm a comic artist." I go, "All right, so you write the Simpsons?" You go, "No, you've sort of completely misinterpreted. No, what I do is I draw Judge Dredd." And they go, "Oh, like the movie?" "Yes, that's close enough." Just like the movie, yeah. So I think the movies helped sort of bring about. I mean, the other thing about, I don't know how it ever was in the States, but certainly in the UK, comics were very much an underground thing. Comics would have been the thing that you'd have got beaten up for when you were 15 if you were still reading them, mm-hmm. Certainly in Belfast, although in Belfast, any excuse to beat you up was good enough. You'd have hidden your comics under your dirty magazines. Kept them out of sight so no one knew that you read comics, I remember, actually, there was a magazine called Computer and Video Games that I used to buy when I was about 17, because it was, 50 pages of video games articles and 2 pages of comics, and I bought it for the 2 pages of comics so that I could say that I was buying it for the video games.
Oh, hilarious.
It's a sad story. It's not hilarious, it's sad.
Oh, no. Well, I guess it's funny, because I guess in the States, it's sort of turned. Like, when I was growing up, comics were something that you would get made fun of in school for reading. But now it seems like, I don't know how it is over there, but it seems like it's the cool thing now.
I dreamt of being made fun of. In those days, we'd have got beaten up. Being made fun of would have seemed like a light relief. I think what's happened is that comics died. It's like a forest that needs a cleansing fire. We've mm-hmm. had our cleansing fire. Comics have effectively died and have been dead for years. And now they're starting to show green shoots of recovery. And by virtue of doing that, nobody has an idea of what comics are anymore. So anyone that sees them are coming to them completely fresh. And then you've got a culture that's very different than when I was 7 or 8. Like, my kids play video games. My son plays Minecraft. They are sitting in the back of the car using iPads and reading stuff and looking at stuff. And they're much more sort of trained to think visually than they would have been, than kids would have been 10 or 15 years ago. And they're much more sort of open to the idea of entertainment in different forms, like comics. But of course, the problem is that the comics industry itself is still in a bit of decline, and the comics industry as it exists is a bit, you really have to understand it to enjoy the benefits of, you sort of want comics to be like walking into an orchard and picking apples anytime you want. But the reality is, comics are like being a farmer and having to farm for the apple trees and then getting the apple trees. Because, you know, I was saying to, I was talking on other radio thing the other day that you know, I want people to go out and order Number Cruncher. Number Cruncher is out in July. But the actual, if you want to read Number Cruncher in July, you need to go to your comic shop now and ask them to order a copy of Number Cruncher from the March previews. And the, you know, the order code is MAR131298. It's MAR131298. So if you order it now, then come July, you'll be able to read that comic. If you don't order it now, what'll happen is it'll be hit and miss whether the comic shop will actually order it or not. And the chances are they probably won't, because it's not an X-Men comic. Although Simon writes the X-Men, so maybe they will. Maybe there's a good chance that we'll get into some stores. But you really need to actively go out and order these things up. And that's kind of one of the weird things about the comics industry that normal people don't understand.
Yeah. And it is really weird how it's sort of become a print-on-demand.
Yeah. I mean, it absolutely suits publishers and it absolutely suits the creators, but it makes it very difficult for anyone to get into. You know, it means that if you have a child and you go to your nearest comic shop and you go, let's have a look and see if there's any comics, and you go, what have you got here? Is there have you got such and such a kid-friendly comic? And the comic shop will go, no, but we could have it in 3 months if you want.
Uh-huh.
And you go, oh, right, okay, well, all right, my seven-year-old, you can wait 3 months before reading that comic. You know, that's not going to work. I think what's going to help a great deal, and it started to help, is apps like Comixology and the iPad, where it's very, I mean, I read, the only monthly comic I still actively seek and read is Lock and Key. And I will, when it's available, I'll just buy it. I don't have the wherewithal. I don't have the kind of the free time to nip down to the comic shop, order it in 3 months' time, go home, come back and see if it's in yet, and then pick it up and then come. You know, that's not a spontaneous reading experience.
No.
Now, though, with my iPad, I can go, oh, there's a new Lock and Key, brilliant, I'll buy that. Oh, I can read it straight away, brilliant. Oh, no, it's over. Ah, nuts. You know, that's my general experience.
Well, it's returning. It's bringing comics back to that impulse buy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's where they should be, where they need to be. I mean, when I started reading comics, it would have been because I found them in my local newsagents. I mean, I'm not naive. I can understand why we are where we are.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand what's happened with the industry to move it to where we are. But I think it's allowed itself to become very much a sort of, it's allowed the demographic to shift to be very much older. And, you know, an older demographic just gets older and older and older. And, and apart from being able to bring your kids into it, it doesn't really encourage any sort of new readers. You know, I mean, I don't know where your nearest comic shop are, but my experience is they tend to be tucked away near all sorts of kind of dodgy shops that you don't want to walk past with your kids. You know, at one point, my nearest comic shop on time was in a row of sex shops, and then there was the comic shop.
Oh,
and you think,
my.
this is not a good thing. I mean, now actually, luckily they've moved, and they're right smack dab in the city centre, which is a great place, and it does mean kids can go in and see them. But at the same time, they can only see what's on the shelves. What tends to be on the shelf now are Pokemon and. That's short my age. No Pokemon. No one cares about Pokemon anymore. Moshi monsters and all sorts of other things. You know, it's more of those kind of things than comics and games and so on. But I do think, I mean, my son, we picked up a couple of comics on the iPad, and I read them with my kids and they loved them. And, you know, if they ever want to read them, they can. The only thing stopping a massive influx of new readers is the price of comics. Even digital comics are quite pricey.
Yeah.
But that's,
That'll change.
That's where they are.
It has to.
Yeah, I think so. With volume, it'll change. You know, at some point, we're going to start seeing a mass audience return to comics, I hope.
Yeah.
And when that happens, we can start seeing prices actually drop. I mean, as it is, I know. One complaint about digital comics is they tend to be almost the same prices as print comics. But One thing I've noticed is that a lot of print comics are chock full of advertising, whereas digital comics have no advertising, yeah. Which means that if you took the advertising out of the print comics, how much more expensive would they be? You know, yeah. It doesn't bear thinking about, really, but I've seen some print comics where there's an advert every other page, and it just makes the comic itself almost entirely unreadable, you know, yeah. As an experience, it's just awful.
I think as soon as something like Justice League starts selling more digitally than it does yeah. in print, that's when we'll start to see the price drop.
Well, we're already starting to see. One of the things that I've always sort of said about digital comics is that it's going to change a lot of things about comics. It's not just going to change. You can't, you know, it's one thing to put existing material onto digital comics, but why do we stick to a monthly schedule? You know, why do we stick to a certain set number of pages? You know, we stick to a monthly schedule because, you know, there are logistics involved, and those logistics require some sort of schedule to be kept. And there's 22 pages because, you know, comic pages are multiples of four because of the mm-hmm. binding and printing process. And comics are a certain physical size because, you know, this is the way they all are, and these are the way the size of the bags and so on. But once we're starting to see it now. You're starting to see a change in all of those factors. You're starting to see DC doing a lot of digital first comics that are weekly and 69 cents. So it you're getting less for your comic. You're getting about 12 pages instead of 22 pages, but they're cut up in such a way to make it feel like you're getting about 22 pages, mm-hmm. and because they're only 69 cents or is it 69 cents? Something like 99 cents.
Yeah, it's 99 cents here.
Yeah. There's 69p in the UK, but they're 99 cents in the States. But that change of price and that change to a sort of weekly delivery kind of changes a whole lot of factors, I think, and it'll be interesting to see how that goes. And there are things happening in comics that you and I maybe don't even notice because they don't happen within the comic industry. So, for example, I think... wasn't one of the top selling comics on digital sold 1 million comics, and it was something like Cut the Rope or something. It was a comic
Pocket God.
Yeah, Pocket God. There you go. And like that's almost a comic industry on its own. Yeah. Without, you know, and we don't even notice it. So there's this massive audience for comics that we haven't tapped anywhere near yet. And it could well be that what's going to happen is we're all going to realize that superhero comics aren't what everyone wants to read. I remember years and years ago, a friend of mine posited the idea that a true mass medium type story is a soap opera. And yet there are no soap opera style comics. Where are the soap opera comics?
X-Men.
You know, but that's basically superhero.
Yeah, that's
soap
true.
You know, where is the, I don't know what, I can't think of what you'd have in the States, but in the UK it's EastEnders or something. Where's the EastEnders comics? Where's the, you know, those comic, Coronation Street comics, those comics that are about sort of long-running, long-established soap operas
yeah.
about who's marrying who and who's sleeping with whom. I suppose you're right, the X-Men is that kind of thing. But the X-Men has become this kind of sci-fi, it's become its own barrier. You know, it's you really need to know everything about the X-Men to read it, you know.
Yeah.
It no longer looks like normal people doing normal things, but with the occasional superhero. It looks like a whole bunch of weirdos doing weirdo stuff. I'm only bitter because no one's asked me to draw the X-Men.
But I think that's going to be the quote on the next issue. Weirdos doing weirdo stuff, PJ Holden.
Well, you know, if you can find me a more succinct description of the X-Men, I'm willing to listen to it.
That's why it's so funny, because that is on the nose. Hilarious. And you, because Psy is writing an X-Men.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I believe it's going really well, and I'm quite sure the protagonist is not based on Simon at all.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Not even slightly. Not based on his look. Not based on nothing about him.
There was a. Did you see that video that went around when the first?
Oh no,
came
no
out?
I haven't. No, was it one of those kind of AR videos with?
I don't know if it was an AR video. I definitely saw it online, but it was Psy talking, and then the camera sort of like panned up, and he had the same hair style.
Yeah, that's our Simon.
It was hilarious and very well
done.
It's
funny because say I've known Simon since he was about 17 or 18. So I've known him when he was an uncouth youth, and trying to break into 2000 AD and stuff. You know, once you get past a certain age, your idea of who everyone is freezes in time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in my head, he's still 18 or 19. But he was talking the other day, he said the other day, that we need some sort of reverse Logan's Run where everyone under 30 gets killed. I'm thinking, hang on, but you're like 18, aren't you? Is it, what? You're not 30? Oh my God, I'm so old.
Hilarious. Do you guys, once the run of Number Crunchers goes through, do you guys have something else lined up that you're going to start working on?
Number Cruncher, what I have, it's one of those, sometimes it's feast or famine with all work, really, but at the moment I'm drawing a Dread story. I'm drawing a war story thing with a writer I can't talk about, but it's a writer I've worked with in the past, and and it will be great. And I'm doing a book called Department of Monsterology with Gordon Rennie, which is I'm actually on part four of, so I've got the final part to draw, which is about a kind of university department who have three teams, field teams that go out and investigate all sorts of things that go bump in the night. So there's Team Carter who investigate kind of dinosaurs and all sorts of monsters. Carnacki who investigate sort of mysterious ghosts, and Team Carter are the space team who've mysteriously disappeared. Carter and Challenger, and each of those teams sort of investigate different things. I'm doing it with a guy called Gordon Rennie, and Gordon's written a lot of Dread, and it's got everything in it we've always wanted to do. And so as soon as Number Cruncher's finished, I'll be full steam ahead to finish that, and hopefully that'll be coming out this year.
Who's the publisher for that?
It's a publisher called Renegade Arts Entertainment. They're sort of a new publisher, and we were going to be. They've done a couple of books, they had hoped to get this out this year, but various things have got in the way. This is my fault and Gordon's fault, but they've been very patient with us. So I really need to finish the book. That's for sure. So once I've done this, I'll be doing that. I mean, it's always lovely to get an opportunity to do something with Simon, but I've got such a full schedule. I genuinely have stuff laid on for the next 6 months, which is scary. You know, I keep looking at the amount of pages I'm supposed to draw and then slightly passing out and then waking up. And it's like, there's a couple of great phrases. One is the phrase "This too shall pass," mm-hmm. which is it's applicable in any situation. There's the story of that phrase is that a great king once said, "I want something that'll make people happy when they're sad and sad when they're happy." And somebody came back and said, "Well, we'll put the sign up saying this too shall pass." But the other phrase, and the one I have to keep in mind the entire time, is that you devour an elephant one bite at a time. So I've got hundreds of pages to draw, and all I keep thinking of. Just do this page. Don't even think about the others. Don't even think about it. So it'd be about 6 months before I'm even ready to consider any other projects. But I think I've half promised a different thing with a different guy that I is too early to talk about. My experience is the moment you start talking about something that's you haven't put pen to paper about, that's when it dies. That's when something disastrous happens and it stops dead in its track. It's always far, far more fun. And even then you get superstitious about stuff. Even when you've done something and it's finished and you know it's going to be published on a certain date, you start thinking to yourself, what can go wrong? Something can go wrong. I know something can go wrong.
Mm-hmm. Fire at the printer.
Yeah, so one of those things. Every page is upside down. Oh. No, hang on. That would be all right.
Well, it sounds like you're starting off having a hell of a year so far.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because, let's say, Number Cruncher was sort of in the bag. It was finished about 2 years ago, I think, mm-hmm. a year ago. So it was just finding a good home for it. And as it happened, Titan Comics are a kind of new publisher and wanted to come out the gate with a whole bunch of books. And this is one of their launch books, which has been lovely for us because I think if we were their 23rd book published or their 636th book published, I don't think we'd be getting the individual attention from them that we're getting. Their second or first book, you know, this is we're sort of one of the flagship books for them. I really hope I hope it does well for us, and I hope it does well for them as well.
They're doing the new Tank Girl series too, aren't they?
They are, yeah. I think they've, as Titan are sort of known in the UK for kind of they republish a lot of stuff, and they publish Tank Girl. There are Titan collections of Tank Girl, and for a while as well, they would have been republishing Marvel and DC in the UK. But I think they wanted to get into the comics industry. It's a sign, I think, that comics as a as an industry is maybe on a wee bit of a resurgence, maybe coming back a little bit healthier than it was when there are publishers, new publishers, that want to get involved and want to do new and interesting books. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the fact that Number Cruncher is a peculiar little book. I think it's a great book, but I don't think you can easily compare it to anything else out there. I might be wrong. I don't know. You've probably read more than I have, but I think it stands on its own. I think as a publisher, it's an interesting first book to. It's an interesting flag to raise up your mast.
Yeah, I definitely
that
agree.
That's terribly rude.
No. I definitely. It sounds a little rude, but I definitely agree. You know, it is something that's not really like something that. It there's no direct comparisons that I could think of to anything else, and I think that, you know, right now we definitely seem to have a glut of comics hitting the stands, and I think when something is different like this, it sort of has that opportunity to shine in a sea of things that all sort of resemble each other.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, the worry is that, you know, the reason there's a glut of those other books is because those are the other books that sell. So, you know, and that nobody wants anything different. But I kind of hope that, I mean, Simon is doing really well in the X-Men, so hopefully that'll carry over some of his audience. And I think, I'm hoping that you always take a punt. You sort of think, well, I think that's a good cover. I think that's an eye-catching cover, and hopefully that'll pick up some people. And if anyone sort of reads the synopsis of it, then that'll get them to pick it up too.
Yeah,
I hope.
I mean, I hope everyone does. Like I said, I read that first issue. I really enjoyed it. The art is awesome. Really fantastic work you're doing.
Thank you.
And I guess to close out, do you know what progs your Judge Dredd stories are going to start?
I haven't a clue.
Okay.
I don't know. It's one of those things. They give me a deadline. I think the last episode is to be finished in April. So they've given me massive deadlines for it, which means that probably you'll not see the first of it until April sometime. I've also recently done an article for Imagine FX. It's a UK sort of a UK art an illustration magazine about drawing comics using Manga Studio as well. It's coming out sometime this year as well, which is it's an unusual thing because I don't write, and somehow I've ended up by blogging a great deal. Somehow I've ended up writing stuff as well, so it's a kind of cool little other thing that I'm doing.
That's awesome. Do you enjoy doing the how-to stuff? I saw online that you have a few like inking videos and a Manga Studio video.
Yeah, I do. I think, I mean, I before getting into comics, I worked in IT from the age of 14, and almost all of my work was about explaining how things work to other people. Mm-hmm. So I'm very comfortable in that, and I'm very comfortable doing it. And I always flatter myself that I'm very good at picking the best way to do something. If there's 100 ways to do something in a computer program, I can usually find the best way to do it. Because I'm a former programmer and I'm a former sort of IT kind of expert. I'd hate using that. People, I'd be one of those people. People used to call an IT. Oh, you're an IT wizard, aren't you? You're a whiz kid. Be one of those people. You know, one of those people that would squirm whenever somebody said it, and you'd go, "Yeah, all right then." It's a horrible phrase. So I feel very comfortable doing stuff like that, and I quite enjoy doing it. So, because I kind of feel like as well sometimes that the best way to understand something is to explain it. Mm-hmm. And if I can explain it to someone else that I've never met, then it helps me understand it. In the article, for example, in Imagine FX I was doing, it was purely about how to draw a page in Manga Studio, a page of comics. And in the process of doing that, I discovered loads of stuff about it that I didn't know before because I'd never really pushed to try those things. But by having to write something about it, I find myself kind of going, all right, okay, so there's an easier way of doing that. There's an easier way of doing that. So it helped me learn the program a lot better.
How much of your work are you doing digitally now?
None.
Okay.
Well, I dither. I'm one of those people. I am a terrible workman. I always blame my tools. If I'm having a bad day with my brush, I'll look longingly at the computer and think, but you know what? The hell with you, brush. I'm going to draw this page digitally, and then I'll do something all digital. But I find digital stuff is never particularly satisfying. I find that comics is a commercial medium, and the finished artwork is what's important. You know, it's what's actually completed and published on the page is the important thing. So how you get there is utterly irrelevant. It doesn't matter how you get there, because the finished thing is the important bit. But that said, every time I draw, if I draw a good page on the computer, I look at it and I think, oh, I wish I'd drawn that on paper. You know, if I draw a bad page on paper, I think, oh, I'll just redraw that. But if I draw a good page on paper, I think, yeah, that looks pretty awesome, and I'll move on to the next thing. So I find it very unsatisfying. And again, for most people, you know, for the comics industry, nobody cares. Nobody, you know, anyone reading the comic doesn't care if I enjoyed drawing the page. Although I would say that people can, you know, you can tell if an artist really enjoys doing what they're doing. But, you know, nobody's going to tell if I got satisfaction out of producing a good page on the computer or not. But I can tell. So, I you know, so for that end, I kind of, I mean, the process I do actually is partly digital. I'll scan pencils in, and I'll add panel borders in Manga Studio, and I'll print the artwork in blue, and then I'll ink over it. So there's, you know, there's a digital aspect to it. Mm-hmm. And then I'll scan it back into Manga Studio, and I'll work digitally from there, making any corrections and so on. But it does mean that I've got, like, the Dread that I'm doing at the moment, I've got a nice folder with all the pages of Dread in it, and it looks like comics. It feels like comics to me. Digital stuff doesn't, you know, it doesn't, it feels like you're taking the romance out of the job.
Yeah.
You know? And when it's a job as badly paid as comics, you want as much romance in it as possible to get.
See, that's all real interesting, because, you know, I feel like your style of inking yourself and sort of your brushwork has a liveliness to it, and your lines are very there's a deliberateness to them.
Yeah,
and I wonder how that translates to digital.
Well. It's funny. I mean, one of the things I find that the line I get out of a brush has life to it that mm-hmm. I don't get out of any other tool. And there was a couple of years there, I kind of used a brush. The first work I did for 2008 was all brush. And then I used a brush for a couple of years. And then I went to pen, and then I went to different tools and kind of hovered around using a pen a lot. And then I did some stuff digitally and went back to using a pen and occasionally used a brush. But this Dread that I've done about 14 pages of it so far, and it's all been brush, and I've gone back to using the brush, and I find it very satisfying. I find that even a simple straight line with a brush has a life to it that you can't get with any other tool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a kind of, I don't know whether it's translating and I mean, you have to be very slow and deliberate when you're doing the lines with a brush, especially if you want that line to be nice and steady, but equally you can do them very quick. But even, you know, even the simplest of small lines has a life to it with a brush that I don't feel I get out of any other tool.
Yeah.
And so I kind of, in that instance, I would say if you see any quality that's, you know, that's got life and bounce to it, it's because of the tool I'm using there. It's nothing to do with me, which is a sort of the opposite of the bad workman, isn't it? That's the, that's a good workman blaming his tools. There you go.
But yeah, it's, you know, that's all real interesting, because even like the smallest line from the steadiest hand with a brush even has just like that little bit of a waver to it. That
yeah.
little bit of something to it that I don't really know if digital can capture yet.
I think, I mean, there are guys that do great work digitally.
Oh, absolutely.
And you think, well, that's really, I'm like, I mean, the king of them would be Cameron Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
James Cameron. Cameron Stewart, who does all of his stuff in Manga Studio. And his stuff is a nice kind of nice style. But part of me, you know, occasionally he'll post a piece of work that he's drawn traditionally, and part of me will always think that traditional looks just a wee bit more like it's got a little bit more life in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, I mean, the drawings themselves are brilliant. There's no, you can't fault them in any way. And I'm sure for him, he feels as happy doing them digitally. But, you know, for me, I think if you put two almost identical drawings side by side, one drawn with digitally and the other one drawn with a brush, I am pretty sure I'd be able to tell A, which one the brush was, and B, I'd be pretty sure I'd prefer that one.
Yeah. I guess it depends on, you know, each person and their tool, you know, whatever
yeah.
you feel most comfortable with.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't in any way criticize anyone else's choices for tool choices. I think
Absolutely.
It's very much a personal decision. But I do feel that the brush is a tool. Just it has a life in it that isn't in any way possible to duplicate with any other tool.
So I guess to close out, PJ, where can people find you on the internet?
I am all over the internet, like naughty pictures of girls. No, I am. If you Google PJ Holden, you'll find I'm the first hit, and then I have a blog which I tend to update. I have been updating daily. It's mostly a sick report. It's mostly me complaining about things being ill, but I have a blog and I'm on Twitter as Paul J Holden.
Awesome, PJ. Thanks for taking the time to talk, man.
Mike, thank you very much for having me. I'm sorry I talked your ear off there.
No,
sorry
great.
We lost each other.
It's great. I love
if you can edit all this down to a brilliant 5 minutes. that would be very impressive. All right.
Cool. PJ,
Mike,
it was a pleasure,
much.
Man.
Then
it was a
go.
Pleasure. Thank you very much. Have a
thank
good rest
you.
Of the day.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye now.
Thanks.